from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
As a native, okay, I never get lost in Walmart, okay? And it has nothing to do with, like, some native tracking system with the sun and the moon and all the stars. If I ever lose where I am, right, I'll just stand around for, like, 2 minutes. I'll just be like this, and then I'll hear this.
Security to be aisle five.
That's comedian Howie Miller, who is out to bust stereotypes through laughter. This hour, rethinking Native American culture. Essayist and curator Paul Chott Smith tells us why movies matter so much to Indians.
We're known to so much of the U.S. public and internationally through the movies, as opposed to us being around a lot ourselves.
Also, why novelist Leslie Marmon Silko is enthralled with the land and the snakes near her home in Arizona. And a fresh look at the life and times of Crazy Horse.
He was a protector of people and a leader of men, and one of those people who, when he came on the battlefield, his friend He Dog said, made everybody brave.
Everything you know about Indians is wrong. That's the title of Paul Schott Smith's book of essays on what he calls the Indian business. Smith is a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He told Steve Paulson that, unlike other people, Indians aren't allowed to change, even today.
I think it remains something distinct about what makes us different. And the way I would pose it is that, you know, there aren't really very many Indians. And in terms of the iconic Indian and feathers, bonnets, and, you know, the idea that people have all around the world, you know, it's interesting. It's such a brief moment in our history. It was a tiny minority of Indians in the hemisphere. And yet that has so captured the imagination of the world that it's hard to escape. I mean, I've been watching, like most people, I'm sure, Egypt in the last month. And Egypt is, and Egyptians are sort of thought of primarily, you know, what do you think of Egypt? You think of the pyramids, you know. But an Egyptian cab driver is not really expected to be able to translate hieroglyphics or something, right? I mean, there's an idea that there's a modern Egyptian nation state and there's Egyptians that program computers. And it doesn't seem to really take away from who they are as Egyptians. But I would argue that with Indians, this idea of whether we can be in the modern world is somehow in opposition to who we are, so that the more we're part of the modern world, the less we're Indian. And I think that's pretty unusual in the world.
Is this just an issue for people who are not Indian, sort of their perceptions of what Indians are like, or is this also an issue for Indians themselves?
It's an issue for us. It's something that we've internalized in a lot of ways, I think. And some of it's flattering, you know, the stereotypes about us, they're not all, you know, negative. To say we, you know, have a really special relationship with the natural world, you know, that's not a bad thing. To say that we have, you know, these amazing spiritual understandings, that's, you know, those aren't negative things. You know, the way I've thought of it is a concept of, like, strategic essentialism, where we actually, I don't know, maybe pander is too strong a word, but we are aware of that sometimes, and it's to our advantage. I'll give you an example. The Iroquois Confederacy in the mid-20th century, trying to rebuild their communities, they wore Plains headdresses at official public events. And, of course, they know they have nothing to do with Plains headdresses, but they knew that the public wouldn't really know how to read their version of the kind of headgear that they have that's traditional. And they said, look, if we want to have an impact, we're going to wear Plains headdresses, knowing full well that's not really us. It's a political choice. So in some sense, it's a political choice. But I think then you start believing it in a way, and you start forgetting it's a strategic choice.
Well, and it goes back to some of the most famous Indians of the last, 100, 150 years, Sitting Bull, Chief Seattle, who are held up as iconic figures, but actually their lives were full of contradictions, weren't they?
Yeah, Geronimo is a great example of somebody who went from being basically a bin Laden-type figure in the U.S. national imagination to being part of Teddy Roosevelt's inaugural parade in the early 20th century and becoming a national icon. And so, you know, the idea that Indians were unable to change and unwilling to change. You know, when you look closely at a lot of these examples, you see people who actually were ready for the world, were up for being in Buffalo Bill's Wild West or selling their photographs or being part of a presidential inauguration. And that always, and including how we perceive it as ironic or funny, but I think change has been part of the Indian world from the beginning, that the great imports were what? Guns and horses, right? None of them were indigenous. So somehow it just got sort of fossilized at a certain period where, okay, this is all right. You can have the horses, you can have the guns, but that's it and no more. And I think that's continued, you know, throughout the 20th century into the present.
Well, let me follow up on something that you've touched on, and that's the romantic view of Indians that a lot of non-Indians have. And there's sort of the whole notion that Indians are sort of have this special bond with the earth, that they are sort of have this inherent spirituality. Is this racism, this kind of romanticism?
Yes. It's a benign, seemingly benign racism, but it is, yeah, it's what I would call it.
Why? I mean, in some ways, these are very positive depictions of Indians.
Well, because it says that this is what defines Indians and that all of us are part of that or we're not Indian. So all of these things have some truth. But that, you know, going back to how, you know, what really characterized Indians in 1491 were, there weren't any, first of all, and how utterly different most of us were from each other. And so the creation of this idea that says it's these whole set of things that are just one aspect of some people, that becomes predominant, you know, I think that's what justifies that term.
And, of course, it's hard to get away from the depictions of Indians in movies. And you say that Indians themselves are very invested in Hollywood's portrayal of Indians. And, of course, there have been a lot of movies over the years, going back to the whole cowboy and Indian kind of craze in the old Westerns. Should we take these movie depictions seriously? Do they matter?
For a lot of Indian folks, there's still this tendency to critique the movies based on how accurate they are. And, of course, movies are never meant to be accurate. Movies aren't in the business of showing, you know, exact replications of what we actually look like or said or anything else. It's part of a national mythology. But the reason it's so important is because most Americans today think they don't ever see Indians. In fact, they do because, you know, the gardener, construction worker, you know, might be Mayan, but that doesn't count somehow. We're known to so much of the U.S. public and internationally through the movies, as opposed to us being around a lot ourselves, you know. It gives the movies a much bigger importance, I think, than really almost any other group.
Now, you go on the record as saying that you really hated Dances with Wolves, which in some people's minds was really the first sympathetic portrayal of Indians in Hollywood. Why did you dislike that movie so much?
Everyone else in my family liked it, so I was a minority view. I think most Indians liked it. And it was sympathetic. And it was, you know, just the fact that so much of the movie was in Lakota. You know, that's like, wow, a movie subtitled in Lakota for big chunks of it. That's, you know, that's new. That's impressive. And clearly, without a doubt, you know, that the writer and director and actor, you know, they all were doing it as something to show great respect for Native culture. The trope of a lot of these movies is that they're about Indians, but of course it's a love story between two white people. I mean, you can't really get around that.
So that's the thing that you didn't like, that it sort of, in a sense, leaves the Indians themselves as the main characters, and it focuses on these white people, on Kevin Costner and the woman he falls in love with.
Well, I didn't like the aesthetic. I didn't like the, you know, the movie doesn't give you a lot of choice in how to feel about things, and it presents a kind of a one-sided point of view, which, of course, again, is pro-Indian. It represents a kind of falsification of the complexities of the past, both emotionally, dramatically, and historically.
Can you spell that out a little bit? What does the movie get wrong?
I might contradict myself here in saying it's not about accuracy, but it's telling that the actual book and the author of the book, actually it was a screenwriter as well, it was all about Comanche Indians. And so it's interesting that you could change it to Lakota from Comanche. And nothing changed. The dramatic arc, the characters, everything else could stay the same. So that's it. It sort of would indicate an idea of the specifics of what one Indian situation is. The Comanche situation was profoundly different than the Lakota situation. You know, it didn't matter. It could be substituted pretty easily.
Well, let me ask you about an institution that you are part of. You're a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian. And you say that you actually have mixed feelings about the very existence of this museum. Can you explain your ambivalence, perhaps?
Sort of much like the relationship we have to movies, we're really invested in museums as well. And so there's always been this understanding that museums have a lot of our stuff. They actually have a lot of our human remains. And we don't care for that. And we would like museums to be a partner in changing how the world thinks of us instead of being a way that teaches a world to buy into certain, you know, these stereotypes that don't help us. And I guess I bridle at it because nobody in their right mind would say, you know what, we're going to build a museum of Europe and it's going to be about everything in Europe, all of the countries and religions and cultures and dances and beliefs and politics. And we're going to do it in, you know, 4 8,000-foot galleries. I think people would say, you know, that might be a little ambitious. And so I think there's a way that we accept that this is a reasonable task when it's not reasonable. So, of course, you know, the museum struggles with that. My colleagues struggle with that and try to figure out ways to make this something that can be workable. But I think one of the obstacles is just the very idea that, okay, yeah, there could be a museum of Indians. When in fact it's, you would never really think the same, the Museum of Asia.
We've been talking about this idea that just about everything we think we know about Indians is wrong. So if you could hit the reset button, what would you change? What are the fundamental facts or interpretations that we need to get right?
Well, it sounds a bit like science fiction, but I think there's a huge amount of scholarship, including mostly from non-Indian scholars, that really are beginning to think about contact in 1492 as this profound event that created the world we live in today, that it created the transatlantic slave trade, that these halves of the world that had no connection to each other for forever, now we're part of things, Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. And on the level of microbes and animals and ideas and humans, this was the first moment of globalization. The scholarship that talks about tens of millions of people in the Americas, quite likely more than the population in Europe, and the idea of just this incredible diversity of cultures and civilizations. Those are really sort of opposite of what most of us were taught, which is not many people lived here. All of them were very backward. And the Indian story is of no huge consequence. It's a sad story. It's a tragic story. But it's not really, really important. Those are the kinds of ideas I think the world is moving to. Certainly isn't there yet. And I think that's more than just a correction. That does sort of justify the idea of a reset.
Paul Schott-Smith is an author and a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He spoke to Steve Paulson.
Anybody here like the Spider-Man cartoon? I like the Spider-Man. Oh, it was great. I have my own theme song. Same music, different words, goes like this. Native man, does whatever a native can. Steals a smoke, any size, likes to drink, lots of rice. Hey there! There goes a native man! My native sense is tingling. What is that spare change I hear?
Howie Miller is a comedian from Edmonton, Canada. He bills himself as a native comedian and uses his act to bust stereotypes about Native Americans. And Strange Champs asked Miller how he got started.
I found myself trying extra hard to be popular in high school. I was the only native in an all or non-native school. I was adopted into a very suburbanite area and a suburbanite family. So, you know, growing up, I was different anyways, but I always found myself trying extra hard to be accepted, even though my friends accepted me anyways. I mean, I was just Howie growing up. I'm the only one who saw myself as different, and there was a lot of sort of issues growing up there that I was bottling up and waiting to release on stage, as I found out later in life. But I was interested in acting, and I was always a performer. We'd go to these things. What we have here, we have piano bars, and there's a guy singing, either playing a piano or a guitar, and he'll sing. And I got to know these guys, and I would sing with them. And then we put a little act together where I would sing songs as different people, because at the time I liked to do impressions. So that's all I went on with. I was just like, you know, they'd seen me do one of these performances, and they said, you should go to an amateur night, you should be a comedian. And I had nothing to say, really. The first, you know, four or five times I was on stage, I just did impressions. And people thought, wow, the dark, you know, sort of native guy is doing, you know, a Sean Connery impression. This is weird. So they just, on the weirdness of it, I guess I became popular.
When you go out on stage, and these days, you know, your audiences know from the first time you step on stage or even when they buy tickets that they're going to see a native comedian and that your race is going to be part of your act. What kind of material do you like to start off with?
Well, it's the elephant in the room, and I am getting quite larger, heavier set. So when I walk on stage, it's something that I need to get out there right away, just so we can all relax. And if I later on in the show talk about being native, you know, I like it when they're uncomfortable at first. It shows me that they're listening to a non-native crowd anyways.
Hello. How are we? Hey, how are we? Yeah. That's what you're expecting, aren't you? Yeah.
I tell them that I just did that, so I didn't want you guys thinking, you know, when you left the stage, wow, that, you know, that large Hawaiian man was hilarious. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I am Native American and proud of it. And then it eases it in for later. You know, I can say, see, you guys are, you're not as awkward now. You know, you're not looking around to see if the Native people are laughing. You're actually having a good time.
If you have to ease them into it, are there, I don't know, sort of safer jokes?
Yeah, that's usually in the beginning, you know. Hey, thanks for having me here. I hope you guys are still like, are you liking the land still? Are you liking it? Good. I love what you've done with the place. Looks great. We're going to want that back, though. Yeah, I hope you know that. Don't want to sound like an Indian giver, but, you know, we're going to want it back.
In the videos I've seen on YouTube of some of your performances, at the beginning, you get this kind of nervous laughter from the audience, and at some point, there's like this big laugh. Sort of as though the audience feels like this is a relief. Oh, it's okay to laugh about this?
That's the whole point behind that act, I think. I've always strived to get that message across that, you know what, because we're dealing with touchy subjects sometimes. We're dealing with racism, and my attitude towards racism is it has to be looked upon as a joke, and eventually it'll go away so we can even stop joking about it. Because, I mean, if you take it seriously, then you're a racist, right? So it has to be viewed as a joke. That's how I view it personally, and I'd like to get it out there as a joke so we can all relax. We can laugh about things. You know, my jokes are interchangeable. I mean, if I was an Irish comedian, I would do the same jokes, but, I mean, it would be, you know, with an Irish accent, and I would be talking about Irish people.
But what do you do about, I mean, if there's real anger underneath there? For instance, that joke you do about the land, you know, you liking the land. Well, hidden under there is centuries of resentment because Native people did get shoved off their land. So how can you joke about it?
It's a way of putting it in the face again to say, you know what, we still remember that. I'm not going to sit here and fight for something that was done 400 years ago that I have no control over. I'm going to try and change it now and think positive. But I would like you to know that we're still thinking about it. But I don't want to hit people over the head with negativity. If I can't bring something to light in a positive manner where we can say, you know, this is just a joke, but I want you to realize that you're still laughing about a situation that's still out there. I'm not good at public speaking, as it were, to send a strong message across, so the way I can do it to still get it out there is with humor. And people have approached me afterwards, you know what, you made a lot of sense, and I want to say that you're actually pretty smart. I don't know if you know what you're doing, and of course I know what I'm doing, but, you know, I get it. A lot of people, you know, they think, people either think it's just really funny jokes or people get what I'm trying to do.
I'll tell you what does tick me off about being Native, though, is Survivor. Oh, I can't stand that show. I'll tell you why. No Indians. You got every color of the rainbow on that show except red, right? I'm thinking, you know, it's probably a pretty good idea, because they're not going to vote me off the island. They're just going to vote me to the crappy part of the island and leave me there for 200 years. Have fun, Howie. We'll call it a reservation. Of course, why would you want a Native on Survivor? Like, what the heck do I know about hunting and fishing? I'd be too good, right? There'd be like me and two guys left. They'd be like, how do we get Howie off the island? He's so good. I don't know. I brought some rye. You were thinking it.
Do you think people, non-Native members of your audience, are actually a little scared at first, and that's where some of the relief comes from? You know, a little scared that here's this big Native guy, he might really be angry.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. That's the point that I want to get across to them, that we should all lower defenses because, you know, it's judging a book by its cover. The whole act is sort of designed that way, that you have to read into it. You have to see where this person's coming from. Everyone has a point of view. So when they see this large, grumpy-looking Native man on stage and it looks like, oh, we're in for like an hour of, you know, white bashing, well, you're not. You're missing the point. I'm going to mention stuff about wanting my land back. I'm going to mention, you know, some stuff about, you know, how the situation is right now. But I'm also going to make light of everyday things, relationships, my marriage, my children. Just to say, like, I'm a regular person too, and we all have problems, but here's mine.
So you do a certain amount of playing with the stereotypes of Native Americans. Well, I guess in Canada, you're First Nations. Isn't that the right terminology?
I prefer when people call me Howie. That's where I want to end up eventually. It's weird that I'm doing this interview from the CBC Radio here in Canada. I did an interview with them a while ago in Ottawa. That's our nation's capital. And it was a live interview. And the woman, I forget her name, and I feel bad to this day about it because she asked me that question. She says, what do you prefer to be called? Do you prefer to be called First Nations, Native American, Native, Indigenous? Which do you prefer to be called? And I said, well, I prefer to be called Howie. And she went redder than I was, and she was all apologetic on the air. She said, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean it. I go, no, see, it's okay. It makes a tense situation. But in reality, it's just, you know, it's just a name, you know. It's not a definitive thing. I'm Cree from Alberta. I'm part of the Cree tribe. But again, I'm adopted by, you know, white, German, Scottish parents, so.
So, yes, I am Native. I'm Indigenous. I'm First Nations. I'm Aboriginal. I'm sick and tired of all the political correct crap. You just call me Caucasianly impaired. Thank you. I don't mind being Native, though. I like the free stuff. You know, like the land, the education, the health care. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but here in the city, I get free cab rides. Well, they're cop cars, but they get you home. They're
Are there jokes that kind of go a little too far that your white audiences don't quite get or are a little uncomfortable with?
If there were any, I would have stopped doing them immediately. I try to be more general in my stage presence. I do a lot of, you know, solely Native functions where actually I can get a little more deeper into, you know, how life on the res is, and, you know, they love, Native people love to laugh. So, I mean.
So what's an example of a joke you could do before a Native audience but not before a non-Native audience?
Well, that they wouldn't get, like a non-Native audience wouldn't get, you know, being on a reservation. You always know when you're on a reservation, first of all, because when you're driving, out of the blue, you could be, you know, you have to stop for like about 150 dogs that just cross the highway. It's their road, you know. Some of them only have three legs. One had no legs, I saw. It was kind of funny. And it doesn't matter how downtrodden the houses are on a reservation. Sometimes they're a little beat up and everything, but they always have a satellite dish in the corner so they can watch the hockey game, or in your case, the hacky game. So there's stuff like that that, you know, my non-Native crowd might not really understand. I know people that have never been on a reservation. Or that they know of. So that's what I always tell the white people, you know, you always know when you're on one, when all of a sudden the road goes to a single lane highway and there's 100 dogs at any point given time.
You were talking about, you know, what part of the power of comedy is that by getting people to laugh about uncomfortable things, you can talk about things, talk about stereotypes that are taboo. Have you ever had a moment like that where you felt like you'd really pushed through some difficult territory and you and the audience had gotten to a new place?
Yeah, there was a defining moment years ago when I was first sort of touring around, and I was in this smaller community in their bar. It was a Wednesday night, and this after the show, this large, we call them FBIs for obvious reason, but a very large native man came up to me after the show, and he said he wanted to talk to me. And I was kind of scared. I was taken aback. And so I sat down with him, and he explained that some of my act, I shouldn't be doing, I shouldn't be saying those things about native people. And I just told him that I was, you know, I'm not making fun of you personally. I'm not making fun of anybody I know personally. I'm making fun of a stereotype that we didn't create. If I can get my message out there, like I said, in a positive way, then I'm going to try and do that. And I only had to talk to him for 5 minutes, and he totally switched his, you know, opposing arguments against me. And he said, you know what, I understand what you're doing. I understand. I guess I was in the back of the room judging you and not listening to you. Because I retold the jokes to him, telling him to keep that in mind. There's obviously going to be issues that people are holding on to, and they don't want to understand other people's point of views, and they've put up walls as a security blanket. And those people are hard to get through. But for the most part, it's someone like that that comes up to me after the show, you know, and I can either explain it to them and then they get it, or they come up to me and say, you know, I really understand what you're doing. I want you to know that, because that's happened to me before, where I feel, you know, I can go and pat myself on the back now because, like, somebody gets it.
Howie Miller is a stand-up comedian from Edmonton, Canada, and Strange Hands spoke with him. To check out more of Miller's comedy or the books and music from the show, stop by our website at ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up, novelist Leslie Marmon Silko on living deeply in Arizona and the unlikely friends she finds on the ground. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Leslie Marmon Silko lives in the American Southwest, where she paints, writes, and soaks in the natural world around her. A member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe, Silko helped put Native American literature on the map with her novel Ceremony, and is credited with being a key member of what's called the Native American Renaissance. She's the author of a memoir called The Turquoise Ledge, and she read Steve Paulson an excerpt from the book.
Steep banks of violet-blue cumulus drift over the southwest horizon off the Gulf of California. Later in the morning, the rattlesnakes come out in anticipation of the rain. The light is pearly blue and cool enough for the snakes to await the rain. They favor spots near sources of water or shade, so it is easy to anticipate where they may be. In my yard, one rattlesnake sits next to a ceramic bowl, and its twin curls up in the rainwater drainpipe nearby. They lie in wait for little birds and rodents. When I first came to this old ranch house, there were the remains of a mesquite log corral below the hill, and I later repaired it so I could keep a horse. A big black and white western diamondback rattlesnake lived near the old corral. What interested me at once was its calm demeanor. No coiling or rattling when we met. The snake made me feel welcome here. He knew I was a friend of snakes. I was careful to watch for him around the hay barn where he got fat on pack rats. If I found the big snake in the shade of the corral fence when I was making repairs, he patiently tolerated a gentle lift in the bowl of the shovel to a more out-of-the-way place in the shade. I called him Baby as a joke, because it was an unlikely name for a rattler 4 feet long and about 5 inches in diameter. He was a grandfather snake, not a baby. He kept me company for my first 2 summers in Tucson. But after the summer of 1980, when I was away in New Mexico much of the time, he left. The black and white color of the snake was dazzling and unusual, and I always hoped I might see another rattler like him. But more than 30 years later, I have not. Maybe the old snake was a messenger of welcome and more supernatural than I realized at the time.
Oh, that's a wonderful passage. Do you think you had a relationship with that snake? I mean, do you think that snake kind of knew who you were?
I absolutely think so. And part of the reason is because all of the research that's been done very recently by animal intelligence researchers, research done with birds, ravens, even pigeons, and of course the famous African gray parrot research projects. And I believe what's emerging is a new view of the organization of the bird brain and the reptilian brain. Always before, they had compared the reptile brain or the bird brain with mammalian brains, with our brains. And in fact, when I was a child, us children would yell at one another, "Oh, you bird brain," meaning, you know, not very smart because you have a small brain. Now it's emerging that bird brains are to our mammal brains as the old-time tube radios are to digital electronics. And the rattlesnakes very much learn to recognize people. I have a rattlesnake that's lived in the house with us for about 24 years.
Wait, in the house? You let him rattle?
Well, in a not roaming around freely, but in his little house, Evo's little, well, not so little. It's a big box, a big glass box. And when I bring strangers to introduce them or show them to Evo, he very much reacts and knows that they are human beings that he's not met before.
You don't worry about getting bitten? I mean, not with Evo, who lives near you, obviously knows you well, but just a rattlesnake you might stumble on one of your walks?
Well, I'm very careful about that. And a couple of times on my walks, I've had to hop over. Literally, I've looked down, and with my next step, I sort of jump or skip where they've been coiled right on the trail. I'm without illusions. I know that I have to be very watchful. Every person does. It's a form of discipline to pay attention to, you know, to where you are, because yes, I believe that if you bump a snake or step on a snake, that that snake has a right to bite you and you should expect to be bitten. However, my experience has been that they are very forgiving, and that if you're not bothering them or attacking them, but you're just walking along, they'll allow you just to hop over them or step over them like I have.
Hmm. Now, there's a strong spiritual current that runs throughout your memoir. Clearly, you have a deep reverence for the land that you live on. But it goes further than that. And you talk about star beings, which have been the subject of paintings you've done. And I guess before we talk about the paintings, I should just ask, what are star beings?
Well, in the art and in the lore of the Mayan people and the Nahuatl or Aztec-speaking people, actually there's a whole cultural complex that goes from Guatemala all the way, you know, into Canada, in the Americas, among indigenous people, and accounts of beings coming to Earth and visiting indigenous groups. And some indigenous communities will say that they are offspring. Others will say no, but we were told, we were given technology, or we were told to settle here. So that you can go into many different lores and writings of the Americas and find references to visitors from the stars. But especially when you go to Mexico and you see the Aztec and Mayan pyramids, there's a great pyramid to Venus, to the planet Venus. And we now know from other sorts of research and oral literature and so forth, that many of the ceremonies were tied into the appearance of the Pleiades in a certain place, or the shift of Venus from morning star to evening star. And so the ancient people of the Americas, from South America all the way to the Arctic Circle, the people were sky watchers. They were astronomers. The presence of the star beings can be seen in the art with the, it looks like a cross, but this cross is not a Christian cross. It's the sign for Venus, or the sign for stars. And in the Pueblo cultures of the Southwest, and Laguna Pueblo is one of them, you can see in some of the Gatsina or Kachina figures, those figures which represent the sun or Venus or the stars.
Well, and you say they don't much like human beings.
Well, they don't much like human beings, and they don't much approve of how we treat one another and what we're doing with this world. And so from time to time, they visit. I'm not sure that they always deal with us humans kindly, because they've not a lot of respect for what we humans have done to one another and the earth.
And I get the impression from reading your memoirs, I mean, this is not just metaphor you're talking about. I mean, you feel like you communicate with these star beings.
Well, I do. And of course, the fiction writer always has to be on the lookout for straying over into the world of fiction and fictional beings, and have that world sort of push out the everyday world. But I really, after I began to spend time and thought on them, and especially when I was painting their portraits, I really began to understand that these communications with us from such entities is very much like the communication with wild animals and things. It's not done verbally or out loud necessarily. It's done by thought, of course. And once again, thought communication breaking with these languages, English or Spanish or Nahuatl, that come loaded with all of these different, actually, limitations and prejudices. And you would imagine that advanced beings like the star beings would just be able to use, come into human thoughts and human intuition. And so that is how I experience their presence.
Leslie Marmon Silko is a celebrated writer and the author of the memoir The Turquoise Ledge. Coming up next, the life and death of Crazy Horse. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The greatest Indian warrior of the 19th century, which means our perceptions about Crazy Horse tend to begin and end with his defeat of General George Armstrong Custer at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Thomas Powers is the author of The Killing of Crazy Horse, and he says Crazy Horse was a leader on and off the battlefield.
He was not a great orator. He was not a talker. He was not a man of words. We only have a few utterances that really come from him that are quotations from friends who report those things to us. But he was a strong personality. He embodied all the virtues of the Sioux. He was a protector of people and a leader of men, and one of those people who, when he came on the battlefield, his friend He Dog said, made everybody brave.
He was famous for something called brave runs. That was part of his strategy in these battles, wasn't it?
It was. A brave run is something no one in the military would ever dream of doing today. But at that time, the Oglala, at a certain moment in a battle, might get on their horse and race it right across the line of an enemy, especially a line of soldiers lying down, all with their rifles pointed at them. And it would have two purposes. One was to intimidate the soldiers by his bravery and to empty their guns. They were using single-shot rifles. They would all fire at this man thinking they were bound to get him and he would escape unharmed, which is another sign that somebody in power was looking over him. And at the end of it, the whole group of Oglala might rise up almost as one man and decide, this is the moment, Hokahei, and they would charge right on those people. That's what happened at the Little Bighorn, and the end came quick after that.
There was a mystical side to it, too, though, wasn't he? He painted hailstorms on his body. He covered his horse with dust that would magically protect him from bullets.
You know, I remember friends who were in Vietnam in the 1960s, and they all had a magic rock in their pocket, or they all carried their mother's Bible under their shirt. And the Sioux Indians, the Oglala, were like that, too. They had a million small ways of kind of inviting the beneficence of the universe to come to their aid. And Crazy Horse had them, too. He used to sprinkle earth from a gopher hill over his horse. He would stand in the front and sprinkle it on his head, and then he would go around to the rear and throw it across his back. And he would be praying and singing the whole time. And then he carried some herbs in a little pouch around his neck, and he would chew those and mix it with his saliva, and then he would spread it on his body. And he would do a number of things of that kind. Use a smoke smudge, burn sweet grass, all those little things that were intended to put him into the right frame of mind and to invite the universe to be on his side. And Crazy Horse was never killed by a bullet. He had a vision as a young man where he was instructed in how to conduct his life by a man who rode up out of a lake on a horse. And one of the things he told him was that he could not be killed by a bullet. He could only be killed by being pierced while he was held. And in fact, that's what happened in the end. It was a soldier's bayonet entering his lower back and puncturing his kidneys, which killed him.
A sad ending to the story, but before that, he had many successes. Crazy Horse won the first battle in June of 1876. What was that about?
It was about taking Sioux land. In 1874, gold had been discovered in the Black Hills. And that was actually a moment of depression in the United States. And thousands of out-of-work American men flocked to Cheyenne, Wyoming, heading for the Black Hills in order to dig for gold. But it so happened that the Black Hills were part of the Great Sioux Reservation. Only a few years before, Washington had solemnly declared that that belonged to the Sioux forever, in perpetuity. Now they wanted it back. First they tried to buy it, and the Sioux refused to sell. At that point, they just declared them warriors and hostiles and outlaws, and they sent a military expedition to force them onto reservations. But when they attacked the Sioux, they did it in an unwise, overconfident way, and the result was a military catastrophe. That was what happened to Custer at the Little Bighorn, one of the great defeats in American history.
Crazy Horse is famous for having led the Sioux at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He split the army.
At a certain moment, when all the army was in general flight, heading to the top of a hill, hoping perhaps to make a last stand there, Crazy Horse broke them in two. And he began with a brave run that emptied the soldiers' guns just for a moment. And at that point, he said, Hokahei, and the Indians with him all rose up and burst through the line and split them apart. And at that point, the organized resistance of the 7th Cavalry under Custer just came to an end. It was over, and after that, it was just individual men or small groups rushing around the field trying to find safety. But there was no longer a real ability to resist, and they were soon all dead.
So here we have Crazy Horse having won perhaps the biggest battle up to that point against the U.S. Army in the plains of America. And yet a little while later, he was working for the U.S. Army. How did that happen?
He thought about it. People came to him and said, you cannot continue this resistance. I'm talking about fellow Oglala and Brule Sioux chieftains who urged him to bring his people into the reservation and stop the resistance. Crazy Horse just wanted to live apart from the whites, Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull alike, just wanted to live apart. But they came to him and said, no, the whites aren't going to allow this. You have to do this. Crazy Horse as a leader is responsible for the people under him. And the first judgment he has to make is for their welfare. And that's why he surrendered in May of 1877. He wasn't beaten. He wasn't tired of fighting. He just felt that that was the smart thing to do, and he did it.
Of course, he was faced with jealousy and anger and fear among the Sioux as well as among the Americans who were there. We need to talk a little bit about General Crook, I think, who was so important at the end of Crazy Horse's life. He was angry at being beaten, wasn't he?
General Crook was a very interesting American general, one of the numerous generals from Ohio who rose high during the Civil War. And he was a gifted but dogged, implacable kind of commander who made his slow way forward towards whatever goal he had set for himself. He was in command at the Rosebud, and at the end of that day, there were a dozen or 15 dead on each side. But Crook had been fought to a standstill. He came to a halt. He went to ground and waited for reinforcements for 6 weeks. He was beaten there in an important way. Now, 1 week later, Crazy Horse attacked and wiped out Custer. So he was not beaten. He was not fought to a standstill, and Crook brooded over this. People made fun of him. They used to call him Rosebud George, and they made witty songs about his inability to beat the Sioux. So he carried within him an anger. He disliked resistance. He disliked sullen defiance. And he felt that Crazy Horse and some of the other Sioux chiefs were resistant, defiant, refusing to bow. And he had it in for him.
So on the one side, you have General Crook, who had reason to hate Crazy Horse, even though he at this later point said that he didn't. And on the other side, you have the machinations within the Sioux Nation. There wasn't great enthusiasm for Crazy Horse there either. This brings us to the moment at the end of his life that isn't at all clear, except that he died.
He did something quite remarkable. Despite all evidence to the contrary, and there was plenty of it, that the Army had lost faith in him and was hostile to him and wanted to get rid of him, in spite of all that, Crazy Horse trusted them right up until the last moment. He went with them, undefended, with few allies, into the middle of a fort where 1,000 soldiers were on duty because he had promised to talk. And he expected that that promise would be kept. And he believed that promise right up until the minute he saw the bars and the window of the guardhouse door. And then, surrounded by all these enemies, all alone, with no aid, he attempted to break free and escape. At that moment, he resisted. So there's something strange and at the same time magnificent about his willingness to let them do this to him because of his commitment to the promises that he had made. It's quite extraordinary.
All of the accounts are extraordinary, but they don't all agree on exactly what happened, do they? Except that a bayonet went into his back, his lower back, and he died some hours later from the wound. In the book, you say that if there was a villain, it was probably the half-Indian scout, Frank Gruard. Would you tell us a little bit about him?
Frank Gruard was half-white and half-native of the Polynesian Islands. His father had been a Mormon missionary in the South Pacific. But he grew up in the West, and as a young man, he actually ended up living with the Northern Plains Indians, the Sioux in particular. He started off in the village of Sitting Bull. And after a quarrel with Sitting Bull, he moved to the village of Crazy Horse, where he actually lived in the teepee of Crazy Horse's friend, He Dog. Gruard was deeply schooled in the life of the Sioux on the Northern Plains, where they lived, where they went. He was a great scout. He knew every nook and cranny, where the rivers and streams ran, where the difficult country was and the easy country, all of that. He was a great guide and scout. When he left the Indians, he came to work with the Army, and he was in fear that the Army was going to turn against him and find out what kinds of things he'd been doing for the Indians. And to some degree, he'd actually been with the Indians, fighting with the Indians, and served as sort of a spy for them. So he was fearful. And Initially, in May of 1877, when Crazy Horse surrendered, Rouard was his friend, but he became suspicious of Crazy Horse over the summer, and Crazy Horse did tell people things about Rouard that Rouard did not want generally to be known. So Rouard, as an interpreter, at a critical moment, misinterpreted some of Crazy Horse's words to imply that he was going out on the warpath again and that he wouldn't fight until not a single white was left alive. Now, Rouard planted that idea in the minds of a young lieutenant who was reporting directly to Crook, and so it got to Crook and it completely changed their view of what Crazy Horse was doing. And they were encouraged in this by the other Sioux chiefs who were jealous of him.
And as a result, Crazy Horse, thinking he was going into negotiations, was instead to be arrested and ended up being killed.
That's what happened.
The thing about Crazy Horse is his legend won't go away. He was loved and hated on both sides of that. But as you say, we don't know where he's buried. We don't know exactly what happened that last day. Maybe that's why, I guess, or partly why people have this image of Crazy Horse as something beyond what he could even have been.
He was not a man who could be pinned down. He was his own free self. He made up his own mind. He reached his own decisions. He was a defender of his people. There was something very strong there. He died in defiance. His father said he died in victory. I've often wondered, what could his father have meant by that? And I think it was just that he was true to himself to the last moment. And as soon as you enter into the aura of that story, you begin to sense this. It's a very interesting, powerful thing.
Thomas Powers is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and writer. He's the author of The Killing of Crazy Horse. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to hear this program again, or check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 36A, Rethinking Native Culture. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.